Welcome to the West Virginia Educast. This is Trey Marone, and I'm the host. Today, we're going to talk about a very interesting topic that's an integral part of our school systems in West Virginia, extracurricular activities. Our special guest today is Bernie Dolan. Bernie Dolan joined the WVSSAC on July 1st, 2015. He assumed the position of executive director in January of 2016. He received his master's from Western University and a professional administration certificate from Salem International University. Bernie comes to the WVSSAC from Ohio County, where he served as assistant superintendent. He also served as principal, assistant principal, athletic director, math instructor, and technology coordinator at Wheeling Park High School. Bernie has served as the director for the Super Six, director of the state golf tournament, on the OVAC executive board, and on the WVADA board of directors, as well as the WVSSAC board of directors. Bernie resides in Wheeling and with his wife, Jeanette, and they have three children and one grandson who I understand is 1 year old. Welcome, Bernie.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us on the West Virginia Educast. We're excited to have you. You've been a guest on our list for a while. We've been hoping to get you and glad to finally get you on here with us today. I wanted to just first start off by asking you, WVSSAC, I understand, let me get it right, West Virginia Secondary School Activities Commission. I'd just like to ask you, you know, what is the WVSSAC or the SSAC, as a lot of us call it? What is it and what does it do?
Well, first of all, thanks for asking, because oftentimes we're probably one of the most misunderstood organizations. Most people think that the West Virginia Secondary School Activities Commission, or the SSAC, is the building in Parkersburg and the 9 employees there. But technically, we're a private organization made up of member schools who voluntarily are members. There are 286 members at this point, both public and private. All public high schools and middle schools are members. And then a smattering of private schools, both at the high school and middle school level. One of the things that people need to know is oftentimes they think we get tax dollars. All of our revenue is generated by our state tournaments, our coaches' education, our officials, and any of our corporate partners. So it's kind of, you know, people don't really understand where we are and where we come from, but we're not the office in Parkersburg. We are the 286 member schools. It's their responsibility. They make the rules, and it's their responsibility to enforce them also.
So you're the executive director, but your members, I mean, the really who makes up the organization are these 286 schools.
Certainly. They're the power brokers here. They're the ones who, by January 15th, they can propose any rule change.
And well, that's a good point. The SSAC has rules. You know, we hear about those and that there are rules. But where do the rules even come from? I mean, how do you come up with the rules?
Well, oftentimes rules come just like legislation. Something either happens or didn't happen. And a school says, boy, I can't believe we have a rule for this and it doesn't accomplish that, or we don't have a rule. And so by January 15th, they need to submit a rule proposal. And once it's submitted, we have a constitution and bylaws group that will read the rule, and they kind of will make sure that it's worded right and flows and everything. And then we have a board of control, which is our annual meeting. And it's usually end of March, 1st of April. That's when we vote on the proposals. So at the first day of that meeting, whoever proposed the rule would then come up and give their rationale for the rule. And then it's an open floor at that point for anybody to speak for or against the rule. We go through all of our rule changes like that. And then the next day, we come back and we vote on the rule changes. The rules that are successful and pass are submitted to the West Virginia State Board of Education. The Board of Education will then put those comments out, put the rules out for comments. Sometimes they don't even put them out for comments. They'll say, we're not accepting this rule. It gets put away. Other times, almost all the time, it's put out for public comment for about a month. And then in the July meeting, they will usually read the rule and then they'll decide, they vote up or down. They have final say on all of our rules.
So it's kind of like, you know, when I was listening to you talk, you mentioned earlier on you had 286 members, and I was kind of thinking they're kind of like the legislators. You know, all the legislators can bring ideas to the legislation or the legislature, and they can, you know, bring ideas for legislation. They can sponsor legislation. So similarly, you have 286 members who are bringing ideas or questions, or maybe a clarification might be needed. They bring those things back to the group, the membership, and then the process begins there, right there with the members.
Yes. And, you know, so again, just like the legislators, something happens in their area and they want to bring and at least address it and see if they can write a rule that would address that. There are times that we will also write emergency rules. And that is when the office writes an emergency rule, usually to deal with legislation. For instance, we had some new rules on concussion, new rules on heat acclimatization, things like that, coursework. So we make an emergency rule to deal with that, but then it gets voted on just like every other rule in April.
Well, that's good to know, good to understand, because I think, you know, there's a lot of mystery sometimes. People just think, like you may mention, that the SSAC is just this office of a handful of people in Parkersburg that's kind of running everything, when in reality, the membership is very much in control of what goes on in the organization, and even the rulemaking, and really everything goes through the membership, right?
Yes, sir. We also have a board of directors made up of 10 members. Five of them are acting principals from all over the state. They have an administrative district, and five are appointed by their organization. Could be the State Board of Education, State Superintendent's Designee, the Athletic Directors Association, School Boards Association, and then the Superintendent's Association. So there are 10 members, a wide variety.
Well, and I was on the school board. When I was a school board member, I was on that. And I'll be honest with you, that was... For me, anyway, I was not the appointed member. Yeah. Didn't really throw my name in the hat, but I eyeballed that position. I thought that would be really a neat meat spot to be in. Well, let me just move on to some other things. We've got a lot to talk about, I know, here today. You have seen a lot of changes. I mean, really stemming back from the beginning. I mean, even if you were, you know, at Wheeling Park High, I mean, you're seeing a lot of things. Of course, since you've been involved, you've seen a lot of things over the last several years as well with the SSAC. But let's specifically talk about the changes of things like homeschoolers, you know, intercounty transfers, charter schools, and the like. You know, how has the SSAC adapted to those types of changes?
Well, first of all, one of the biggest changes that's happened since my time as coaching, even, you're aware of all the rules, has been all the safety things. Our sports medicine department of our office is growing as big as the regular rules. So we are putting a lot in there on safety. But the things that really have changed also is the transfer. We used to have a rule that allowed you to transfer. You know, you could go to a new school every year. And at high school, you could be at school A as a freshman, school B, sophomore, junior, senior. And it was made life in our office apparently easier because everybody was always eligible.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't really fair because people could stack teams and you weren't playing for where you lived and you weren't really committed to that school. You didn't have to be. You only had to be committed for 1 year. And also, it wasn't very good educationally. That if you were ending up in four different schools, even if it was three, moving around trying to find a better place. So we put a new rule in place in about 2006, and it basically said, as a high school kid, ninth grader, you can go wherever you want. As long as you provide your own transportation, you live at home. But you have to stay at that school the whole 4 years. If you don't, there's a possibility, high probability, that you're going to be ineligible. And so it allowed people to make educational choices that might not be in their district, but they wanted them to go to a certain school and they were able to. That's been one of the biggest changes of all the appeals. You know, when you're ineligible, you're always allowed to appeal. In the summer months, it's not unusual for us to have 20 appeals and 18 of them are residence transfer, you know, and so kids are still moving. They're unhappy. They're moving. They're transferring. But there are a lot of rules for transfer. And again, all these rules have been made by principals because they have a vested interest in the student, you know, and so they want them to have a good academic experience.
Well, the principals who are generally going to be the ones representing your members, they're the boots on the ground. I mean, they're the ones dealing with these transfer issues face-to-face and even within their county sometimes, you know, so that's great to have them involved in the whole process. I was thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even the transfer rule, since it was initially adopted, you all have always kept your eye on that and have tweaked that over the years to address certain things that maybe there's always something new. I'm a lawyer, yeah, so there's always something to twist that can turn up in a case. So, you know.
And I'm sure between this year and next year, you're going to see a tweak of that rule again. Yeah. You know, there'll be a word or two taken out or something added. You know, there are unintended consequences sometimes, and some group of schools might have been getting an advantage the way the rule went. So after a couple of years, people say, oh, this is not fair. Mm-hmm. So then there's a tweak to that rule.
So it's just a very fluid process. You've got a lot of people involved. The members are, you know, those with the vested interest of their schools, you know, so that sounds like a really good setup that I'm not sure a lot of people really understood and understand how that works. One thing that I would like, if you could take a second to remind our listeners of the rules for homeschool students who want to participate in extracurricular activities.
We worked very hard with the legislature because this was, I won't say a hard pill to swallow, but we knew there were a lot of pitfalls. If it was just carte blanche, you could go to homeschool and participate. We wanted to make sure, one, that the kids were actually taken care of, and two, we wanted to make sure the schools received some funding for that. So prior to 2 years ago, a homeschool kid could participate only by being enrolled in four periods. So even though you're homeschooled, you still had to go into the school four periods a day. And I worked with, the house chair, you know, he was very honest and said, I can't do that. I can't run my life while I work and then make sure I run back and forth. So we worked hard. The next year we came up with that you could do virtual. So then we had the combination of virtual and in-person and combination of four. And again, that was still pretty complicated and difficult for people to manage. And so 2 years ago, the legislation passed that allowed homeschool kids to participate in extracurricular activities. And there were a few caveats. Number one, you had to be a homeschool kid for a whole year. You had to be a homeschool student. You had to be have taken the nationally normed test, any of them, and have been in the fourth state nine or higher. You had to live in the district. You had to live with your parents, and you go to the school in that district. And so the 1 year of being homeschooled certainly helped us because one of our concerns would be that I'm eligible starting football. I make it through football. I'm getting close to basketball and I'm not doing so well. I want to drop to homeschool and keep playing. And so the rule is written as well as the legislation that if you go from regular school down to homeschool, then that's a transfer and you're going to have to sip 365. But we have had a big number we have participating as homeschool students because they don't technically report to us. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they will call us and we'll help them work through the process. I've worked with a homeschool advocate from Southern West Virginia, and Jamie and I have a great relationship. And so every time I've got a homeschool question, I call her. And when she's got an athletic question, she calls me. And we've been able to work through almost every homeschool issue that has come up.
Well, you know, and we talked a little bit beforehand with your background and even mine, identifying a problem is key, your initial step. Identify what the issue is, and that doesn't have to be a problem, and figure out a way to solve it. And it sounds like you're working through that process and have had to work through that process with homeschool. You identify the issue and you address it. And you come up with a solution that's fair and reasonable, it sounds like, is what the objective is. And That leads me to my next question. Now we have in progress, I guess, at this point, you know, applications being considered for charter schools. So, you know, let's talk about that if we can, or to the extent we can. Will charter school students be able to participate in public county school district extracurricular activities? And if so, how does or will that work?
Well, first of all, I mean, as we watch the legislation and watch things actually being created, we'll develop a response to it. But my initial response would be, these are going to be public schools, and therefore, they'll be able to be members by themselves. They'll be able to become a member, just like a Spring Mills became a member when they broke a couple of the school students from Hedgesville and Martinsburg to make Spring Mills. I would think that the public charter schools would have their own school and be a member. Now, the only one that confused me or concerns me is the online, because there'll be kids from all over the state. So I'm not sure how that one's going to work out. But I'm sure it'll be high on our list in the future.
Well, and you know, you mentioned, I think at the outset with your membership, you know, 286 members, and I think all public schools are members and some privates. Is that what you mentioned? And then charter schools, you know, is coming along, which is considered a public school. So it's certainly a challenge on how to do that, but it's not the first test the SSAC has faced, right? So we'll look forward to seeing how that unfolds with you and wish you the best in doing that. Yeah, I kind of want to shift gears here to, we talked a little bit beforehand. I've played high school football. Sarita can have her wonders, by the way, anybody's listening. State champions, 1978. But anyway, you know, high school football certainly has evolved so much over the years, at least in what it, well, I mean, it's always been a big part of West Virginia, as so many sports are now. But we now see high school football games being televised on ESPN. Wow. Who would have ever, of course, when I was in school, we didn't know what ESPN was, did we? We realize we're about the same age. What role does the SSAC play in the commercialization of secondary school sports activities in West Virginia? What role does the SSAC play? And if you could, just in your response, do county boards have a role? So you might want to, if you could, you know, address that too.
Sure. And part of that is based on the rights of the games. Who has the rights at the regular season games for all of our sports? The regular season games belong to the local school and who is controlled by the County Board of Education. So there are policies about who can video, who can radio. You know, radio used to be the thing, then TV, but now it's streaming and it's everywhere. And thankfully we have it, because the last couple of years, because of COVID, we've had limited attendance. And therefore, people are still able to watch their games. But the actual streaming, for the biggest part, is all done locally by the school, and they contract people. We have, through the National Federation, which is what the WVSSAC is a member of, they have a NFHS network. So you can belong to this network, and you would put all of your games up on the NFHS network. You pay a monthly subscription, and you would see every game live for that month. You would pay $10.99 for a month, and you could watch multiple games. You can watch games all over the country. So the streaming of games has really become prevalent. You could have a simple phone, and people are doing Facebook Live. And there are some drawbacks to it, because if people are watching at home, that means they're probably not at your game. You know, and all of the schools, just like the SSAC, survives on gate revenue. And so you can't just give that away. And so I think the schools are working to, number one, figure out a way to charge those people who are streaming their games, but also figure out a way to put advertising on there so that you can make it up, that lost revenue.
I can remember a few years, it's been several years back, you know, my kids all went through, they're all, you know, graduating high school at this point, but I can remember sitting at a ball game and asking somebody after the fact, did you see that game? They said, oh yeah, I watched it on Facebook. And I'm like, what? And you know, somebody was at the game just streaming it. That was, you know, it was before it kind of got more of a common thing. And I was really surprised. I thought, oh, well, that's pretty interesting. So yeah, that's evolved. And so, you know, it sounds to me like that while the county school adult boards are involved with regular season, but you likewise, the SSAC, I guess, gets involved when it comes to the postseason activities?
Yes. Okay. So in the postseason, we're a member of the National Federation. So all of our events, all of our championships are broadcast on the NFHS network. We also have, before that came along, we had a contract with Metro News to do football, basketball, and baseball. So you can watch those live on Metro News. And really, there's no better organization that promotes high school sports and does such a great job in the product is Metro News. But it's a great thing. But oftentimes, we think of streaming and the promotion of these games as Friday night football or Tuesday or Friday night basketball. But in reality, to the aunts and the uncles and the brothers and sisters who don't live in the area, that JV game is just as important as the Friday night game. So some of they have what's called Pixelot cameras, and they mount them and they video the games automatically. All you have to do is schedule. I don't know how it works, but it follows the ball on a basketball court, follows a football field, and it allows you to make sure that anybody can see whatever level of game. And I think for the freshmen, the middle school kids, the grandparents, especially during COVID who couldn't come, get to see them, and they didn't miss out on that. So it's really turned out to be a real benefit over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. You know, we're hearing a lot about regionalization and consolidation of county boards of education. If that were to occur, how would consolidation of county boards or regionalization, how would that impact extracurricular activities?
You know, again, it's one of those things that we have to wait and see exactly how it plays out. But, you know, the regionalization of counties, if it did not consolidate schools, it just consolidated counties, then each school would still be a member and that would play out. But there are some consolidations that happen. You probably didn't stay long enough in Sarita Canova to enjoy the consolidation, but I went through the consolidation at Wheeling Park High School. You know, we had Wheeling High, Tridelphia, Warwood, and, you know, I was happy because Wheeling High was in bad shape physically. And we got a brand new school, great education, all new facilities. But sometimes consolidations are more difficult, too. You know, High County, if you look at it on the map, is just a little square. But now you've got some of these consolidations that have taken up whole counties. You know, and you look at Pendleton and some of those counties, my goodness, the space in there. And then if we're going to combine those counties with another county that's just as big, you know, what happens is they tend to lose their community connection. And that's what hurts everybody, because everybody wants to go out on Friday night. Everybody wants to go to the boys or girls game, the baseball game. And the school has been the hub. And sometimes that consolidation, if it's not taken into consideration, really takes the soul out of the community.
Well, and I agree with that. And we could spend a good morning talking about school consolidations. Yeah. But, you know, really, you made a good point. I picked on when you were first talking. I was thinking, you know, in reality, the members are the schools. And so just because counties were regionalized or consolidated from that perspective, it doesn't mean the schools disappear. Some could. I mean, I understand that that could result in some schools being consolidated with other schools. I mean, let's say you had two schools that were on either sides of a county border, both of which might be struggling, you know, with in a variety of ways, and a regional or you know, consolidated school system might decide, hey, we're going to consolidate those two schools, make one. But you've been through consolidation of schools, you know, the SSAC has since it began. I mean, since consolidation began. And think about how many schools at one time West Virginia had in it. My goodness, I don't even know the count. I mean, it was astronomical. But so from what I'm gathering, the regionalization or consolidation of county boards, I'm not hearing any way that you think that it would necessarily automatically impact extracurricular activities, at least not at the outset.
I don't see that because we work with the superintendents just because they're the bosses of their county. But in our rules and regulations, they really don't have a position other than they have given our office or the organization the rights to create rules and regulate. But in general, we're a principal organization that's tied to the individual schools. Yeah. So it might, I mean, we've talked about Chapmanville Regional and the consolidation with Harch. It's across the county line. Harch was in Lincoln County. Chapmanville is in Logan County. And those kids actually leave Harch and go to Chapmanville.
They're represented through Chapmanville. If they're playing sports or in extracurricular activities at Chapmanville Regional, then they're represented on the SSAC. They have a membership just like everybody else does. So maybe the takeaway from this is that, you know, the members are the schools. And unless schools are consolidated, that membership really doesn't change. So the regionalization or consolidation of county boards may not have any impact on it, depending, I guess, what that would look like. So, but anyway, very good. I mean, that gives some very good clarification, I think, to that. You know, of course, we've all, I guess everybody, most people have heard of or seen the movie The Field of Dreams. You know, James Earl Jones' character reminds us that baseball is all that is good and all that can be good again, which is kind of like all high school sports in West Virginia. And I know you continue to do everything you can to keep student athletes on the field, even during COVID. Why is that? Why is that so important?
Well, I think the first point is for the kids, they need to be together. They could be on their phone all they want, but they don't have that personal touch. And Minnesota Athletic Association did a study this spring of 20 when we completely shut down, or spring of 19, that we completely shut down. And they studied thousands of students all over the country. And you can imagine that elevated levels of anxiety and depression were through the roof. And it was because they couldn't be together and they couldn't, you know, they want structure as much as my kids didn't want the rules. They said they really want discipline. They want structure. They want to know what's expected. The things that athletics teach, hard work, you know, all those things that we have learned through athletics play an important role in our lives still today. Hard work. Teamwork. You have to train. You have to study. You have to prepare for things.
Be prepared. I mean, that's the thing I mentioned about, you know, playing football. I mean, most people that know me as an adult that see me more from an academic standpoint, probably, you know, going to college, law school, practicing law, you know, and I always was, I was very, you know, academically inclined in high school as well, but I played high school football in a very successful program. And any opportunity I've had over the years, especially when I was a school board, you know, president, and we would be recognizing, you know, those in extracurricular activities, you know, I would talk about the value of the lessons that were learned, not just in the classroom, but more importantly at that moment, the value of the lessons that were learned through extracurricular activities. For me, football, like you mentioned, you know, teamwork, you know, being prepared, learning how to execute a plan. I mean, so many different, depending on one another for success, working with one another, so many different life lessons that I learned through football. And had a great, of course, group of people teaching us, coaching us at the time. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of that and can see the value that that has was given to me, really, the value of that throughout my whole entire life. So even during COVID, you've done everything you can do to try to allow continued participation and engagement in these activities. So great. Great point. You know, anything else you want? I kind of jumped in there because it kind of got me worked up. I got kind of pumped up with that speech.
I think one of the greatest lessons we learn in athletics, too, is that it's okay to fail. You try. You put yourself out there. You can fail. You just got to get up and go back in the huddle and get ready for the next play.
Absolutely. You know, you look back, I mean, CK won a lot of state championships, but there was very rarely an undefeated season. There were a few, but not many. And honestly, even my senior year, I'm sorry I keep talking about it, but we got beat the first game of the season in overtime. And we never forgot it. And we met that same team in the playoffs. And it was a motivating factor for us. So even in failure, we learned, hey, we can figure this out. We can do better here and we can make a difference and make a change. So, yes, you learned so many life lessons.
And I think right now in this day, I think parents in general, maybe coaches, are so afraid of kids failing that they do everything else to make sure that they keep them propped up. And it's okay. They're going to get knocked. They're going to get knocked down in work. There's going to be things that happen to us on the job that we're not happy about. And you get knocked down and, by God, I got to get up and go to work the next day.
That's right. And there's lots of young people. I'm not saying it's the only reason. Obviously, there's a legal obligation. I mean, you're compelled to be in school, but the motivating factor, I mean, it's all about motivating young people to be the best that they can be. And extracurricular activities, a lot of times, is a motivating factor for someone to be, not only to be in school, you've got sets on minimum grades and things of that nature. So motivated not only to be there, but to perform to at least a certain level that you're eligible. So it plays a big role in the educational system. Appreciate all that you all have done to keep everybody engaged. I know just with me, when the pandemic came along and just, we all started, working from home and doing things differently, that lack of engagement with people and seeing people makes a big difference. So see that, recognize that. We could talk, obviously, for a long time. I could tell we could. And so I know we want to wrap this up. I'm sorry to actually, it's gone longer just for my, I've probably talked more than I needed to here in this episode.
No.
I love all the stuff, but what would you say, if we could kind of wrap up with this question, what would you say is the biggest challenge facing your organization in the next 5 years?
And again, as you think of our organization, you think of it as 286 members. And I look at them and I see lack of enrollment and other things that kids can do. It's already difficult for some of our small schools to field full teams. And so I see it on their end, lack of enrollment and participation. The actual participation numbers haven't been bad, but the enrollment keeps dropping. The rising cost of everything, expenses, officials, coaches, equipment, the price of a ticket to get in, the technology that you have to do. And two of the last things that are challenges would be trying to make sure we have a sufficient number of officials to have games, because if you don't have officials, we don't have games. And we're not at the point right now where we're changing too many games to make sure, but certainly officials are a challenge. And I see coaches. You don't see coaches like Coach Ward anymore that stay there for 20 years. Oftentimes they go through with their kids and then they move on. And so it doesn't keep that continuity. And I see the constant need to continue to hire more coaches is just that people just can't stay with it as long.
Well, you've mentioned two things. I come from a family of coaches. My wife, my brothers, my mother was a coach for many, many years. Sisters coached. I mean, it's a tough job. Obviously, nobody does it for the pay. But that longevity and building that program is what's key there. But you sometimes wonder why people who they give so much time and energy to coaching sometimes take a lot of criticism. So it's tough, and it's not usually from the athletes,
exactly.
That criticism comes. And same now, I will say the same thing about officials, and I wonder about that. Guilty as charged. I've certainly, over the years, hollered at a few officials. Way I look back and I'm embarrassed for myself. I even would have said not bad words, but just just giving them a hard time. And as I matured and got older in life, I thought, first of all, who in the world would want to put themselves through that? Because when I'm at ball games and have been for many years, and I hear people hollering at officials, I'm like, I just want to say, hey, just chill out.
Here's the application.
That's right.
You think it's that easy?
Yeah.
If you can get them all right, go on down.
Yeah.
And I do think that's part of our responsibility as administrators, too, is to not let that get out of hand.
Yeah.
Because if you don't address it, it just continually get worse. But certainly coaches and officials are going to be a challenge moving forward, continuing.
Well, and what a horrible role model it is, including myself. But as my kid, we change a lot when we have children.
Yeah.
And then we get older, we think, hey, I don't want my kids to see me act.
Right. When I would teach the coaching course and talk to the officials, I would tell them, these are perfectly normal parents until they walk into the gym, step into the football field, And then they lose all focus because their focus really is so narrow just on their child.
Yeah.
Is they don't even get to enjoy the game because they get so caught up in it.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. This has been so enjoyable, Bernie. I thank you so much for being a guest on this West Virginia EduCast, a podcast that we are so excited about. You've answered so many questions today that I think people need to hear and understand, because there's a lot of mystery sometimes, I think, with what does the SSAC do and how do they address problems and issues. I appreciate all that you've been able to give us today, and to give our listeners, more importantly, some insight into that from the executive director who does not have an easy job. Same thing I would say, and I'm going to say from here on, so I hear somebody say anything about Bernie Dolan, I'll say, hey, you know, that is not an easy job. Do you think you could do it better? I mean, you've got a lot on your shoulders. So thank you so much for being here and for joining us here today.
And I want to thank you, because it's a great opportunity. Don't always get to have this much time to talk about. And obviously, there's lots of things that go on in our office that could be another podcast.
Exactly.
You know, how do you set championships, and there's lots of things that people have questions on, but I think that I would hope to be asked back at another time and we can pick out some more questions.
Absolutely. And we will. And we did leave a couple kind of cliffhangers in this episode. Yeah. So we can come back on those as things evolve on charter schools, maybe, and some other consolidation of school systems, things like that. But thank you again. And to our listeners, be sure and join us for another episode of the West Virginia EduCast. We will just continue to discuss interesting topics, topics of interest to all of you throughout the state of West Virginia, and even some outside the state of West Virginia, that are relevant to education and education law. Until then, I'm Trey Marone, and this is the West Virginia EduCast. Thanks for taking a listen.